So I don't use PowerPoint, never have. It's never been clear to me whether it's against my religion and will send me to eternal damnation, or whether it would cause me anaphylactic shock and immediate death. I'm not willing to take either of those risks. So I'm just a talking head. The title of this talk was Why Precipitous Population-Wide Whole Genome Sequencing is Probably Inevitable. And my one unhappiness with Mark's talk is that he's written this great paper, much of which we've just heard in the talk, that was called The Case Against Precipitous Population-Wide Whole Genome Screening. So my title was really supposed to be a play off his title, but then he changed his title twice. In any event, I agree with almost everything Mark said. I do note that some of the things he said happily can't both happen at the same time. It cannot both be the case that whole genome sequencing is useless and that it increases economic health disparities. You know, if it's useless, it's not going to create greater health disparities. But in general, I think those are all appropriate concerns. I think in a rational world, Mark would be right, and we would not move forward with precipitous or non-precipitous population-wide whole genome screening. However, and I think Mark probably agrees with this, we don't live in a rational world. Not only do we not live in a rational world, in the healthcare sector, we may live in one of the least rational parts of a deeply irrational world, a sector that spends about $3 trillion a year in the United States, much of it for things much less useful and much more pernicious than whole genome sequencing. So what I want to do in the next few minutes is three things. I want to tell you why I think it's inevitable. I'm going to give you the two caveats, things that might stand in its way from becoming inevitable. And then, to the extent I have time, I'm going to give you my version of problems that will arise from it. I actually endorse and accept Mark's talk. I just turn around the thesis. Rather than those being reasons why we shouldn't do it, although they are reasons why we shouldn't do it, those are problems that are going to happen when we do it, and problems that we need to be thinking about and preparing solutions for now. A couple of initial assumption setting points. I'm going to talk about whole genome sequencing. It could be whole exome sequencing. It could be whole exome plus regulatory region sequencing. I think if you read the ENCODE publications carefully, it's really about 8 to 10% of the sequence that seems to make a difference. We could easily end up doing that 8 to 10% of the sequence, the exome plus the regulatory, known regulatory regions and other biologically conserved regions. My guess is if it gets cheap enough, people will do everything just out of completeness. But every place I say whole genome sequencing, if you want to, you can mentally substitute whole exome plus regulatory region sequencing. Second, what level of sequencing am I looking at? What future do I have in mind here? I have in mind a system where whole genome sequencing, at least as implemented through appropriate protocols, leads to sequences with a very, very high analytic validity, where the actual calls of the A's, C's, G's, and T's are very, very accurate. Accurate enough, at least after, as it goes through the protocol, to be used for clinical purposes. And secondly, I have in mind one that, delivered to the health professionals, or God help us, directly to the consumer's desk, will cost $1,000 or less. So in a world with really accurate whole genome sequencing for $1,000 or less, if that's available, I think it'll be inevitable. Why will it be inevitable? Well, four great attractors, or strange attractors. But affecting all of the attractors is the fact that there will be a big industry out there that wants to sell sequencing machines, and an industry that wants to sell analysis of gene sequence, and an industry that wants to sell pharmacogenomics, and an industry that wants to sell a lot of things. I happen to live in a hotbed of that industry, so maybe I'm a little bit overly exposed to it. But everybody I know at the medical school is involved in at least one company, and usually five companies, trying to do all of this stuff. And Sand Hill Road, which is 2 miles from my house, the world capital of venture capital, is very interested in financing a lot of it. So this is not in a vacuum, there will be a strong political economic force pushing for adoption, i.e. all the industries and companies that expect to be able to make money from it. What are they going to use as the attractors? First, I think, will be technology. If, in fact, some of the new next-generation sequencing methods work, of doing whole sequences and not cutting things up and doing them in bits and pieces, they will be technologically elegant, pretty, cheap, easy, nicer and easier to do than to look at six different genes spread across 23 different chromosomes. There will be a technological drive to it, which may come closest to what Mark referred to as scientific manifest destiny. The technology of it may have a bit of a scientific manifest destiny aspect to it, but I think that's only one of the four attractors. The second attractor, I think, will be price. If it gets cheap enough, and if insurers and other payors look at their world and say, you know, for the average person, we're going to be paying for 1.7 genetic tests during their lifetime. It is our guess. And each of those tests separately will cost $1,000. That's $1,700 per person. But I can get the whole thing for $1,000. Now, that requires a future where insurers think they will be paying for some genetic tests. I think that's probably going to be the case in a variety of different ways. And from the insurer's perspective, you just have to get to the point where the net expected present value of paying for a whole genome sequence once is less than the net expected present value of paying bits and pieces of genome analysis over the next 40, 60, 80 years for some people. So I think price, assuming those criteria are met, will be a very strong attractor. The third attractor is sexiness. The genetics community, particularly high-profile geneticists, have done a great job over the years convincing people that genes are magic. They're special. They're really important. They wouldn't be on the cover of Time magazine nearly so much if they weren't so important. Everybody has heard of the double helix, even though most people still don't know what a helix is, let alone a double helix. They know the name. It's sexy. And for some people, at least, and for some doctors, it will be an attraction to say, I'm getting this cool, sexy thing. Hey, I just got my whole genome sequence done. Like, hey, I just bought a Tesla. Hey, I just got the newest iPhone. That will be an attractor, not for everybody, but for some people. And the fourth attractor, I think, is completeness. This goes in part back to the insurer, paying for it once rather than paying for it wholesale rather than paying for it retail over and over. In part, it goes to some practitioners who want to say, you know, I might as well get the whole thing, see if there's anything there. In part, though, I think it ultimately may go to the legal system, which will wonder, if you had a genetic test and you could have gotten this whole genome sequence cheaper, and with the whole genome sequence you could have seen this MSH2 mutation, which would predispose this person to Lynch syndrome and hence colorectal cancer, but you didn't, and the person died of colorectal cancer, somebody did something wrong, will say a plaintiff's lawyer, and maybe will say a jury. Plus, there are people who just like completeness, collectors. So I think those four things between them, the technological drive, the price drive, the sexiness drive, the completeness drive, in a context where there are companies that expect to be able to make a lot of money off of this, and in the context of a healthcare system, now, what our healthcare system will look like in 10 or 20 years is, of course, completely unpredictable, except that it will not look exactly like it does today. This might well play out differently in the National Health Service or in another country with a different kind of healthcare system. But as far as I can tell, our healthcare system is run primarily for the benefit not of patients, but of all the people who make money off of our healthcare system. And I expect this to be true with whole genome sequencing as well. What I just said is a little bit of an overstatement, but not much. So what are the five pathways to whole genome sequencing? So four attractors, five pathways. Pathway one, we're already seeing. It's the curious, with a lot of money or a lot of connections. Craig Venter, the first person sequenced, or at least about 70% of him was sequenced as part of the Human Genome Project, certainly was curious in a couple of different meanings of that term, and had a lot of money and connections. Jim Watson's genome was sequenced. Probably not a coincidence. It was Jim Watson's genome that was sequenced. But even as long ago as 8 years ago, a guy named West in Bay Area, successful biotech exec, had his whole family sequenced for $50,000. They were interested in it. Hey, it's less than the price of even the cheap Tesla sedan, which otherwise is the status symbol in the Silicon Valley these days. So he got himself sequenced because he was curious, and now talks about all the wonderful things he found, none of which actually strike me as particularly important. When the cost is not $50,000, but as it currently is, around $3,000, you've got walk-in trade from people trying to get sequenced. 23andMe had, for a while at least, as a pilot program, a whole exome sequence for $999. And they ended that not because they weren't getting demand for it, but because they called it a pilot project. They wanted to do X number of people and see how well they could do it. So there will be the curious. There will be the people who have a genuine need for it, usually people with mystery diseases. We're seeing this already with children with mysterious syndromes that look like they're genetic, but we don't quite know what they are. We're also seeing it to some extent with cancers, the more whole exome with the cancers. Just how often that's useful is not clear to me, but it's happening, and it's happening in lots and lots of academic medical centers around the country. So we've got at least two groups who are already getting whole genome sequenced. I think the third group is probably going to be the people who go in for one test, for one family history-related concern, and at that particular point in time, somebody says, you know, why don't we get your whole genome tested? Let's see if the insurer will pay for it. Why not? And there'll be some combination of curious, or the doctor will be curious, or the insurer might be the one pushing it. And so we'll get going from clearly indicated for particular genes or a particular use to whole genome sequencing. And by the way, that particular use might not be just one diagnostic or family history-driven test. It might be something like, we're planning to start a family, and we'd like to do carrier screening. And rather than do carrier screening, for a little bit more, or maybe not anything more, depending on your insurance coverage, let's do whole genome sequencing. Fourth category, I think, will be newborns. I mean, I share Mark's concern about a vast expansion of newborn screening to newborn sequencing. Of course, I was concerned 8 years ago when we vastly expanded newborn screening from five or six things we actually knew we could do something about to 30 to 50 things, most of which we didn't understand squat about and certainly couldn't do much about. Lots of people spoke up about, this is foolishness. We shouldn't do this. Every state does it. I think something like that with whole genome sequencing is likely to happen. And Mark points out, even at a $1,000 genome, 4 million babies a year in the U.S., $4 billion, I'd like $4 billion, put it in my bank account, I'll be a happy guy. $4 billion is slightly more than 0.1% of what our healthcare system spends in a year. With just normal healthcare cost inflation, next year we will spend, what is it, $100 billion more than we do this year? Yeah, something like that. So $4 billion is a lot of money, and it's no money at all. And yes, there are better things we could do with that $4 billion. Would we do better things with that $4 billion? Always a question. Always a problem. So finally we get, I think, to the last category. And I suspect, and it's always dangerous to make predictions about this. It's easy to make predictions. It's just hard to be right. I've found in general it's best to make predictions about the future that are set far enough along that I'll be dead by the time the predictions come, so I can't know that I'm wrong. But I'm going to break that rule. It's a guideline, not a rule. And say that I suspect within 10 years, a majority of Americans will have their whole genome sequence in their health records. And if not 10 years, certainly 15 or 20. So I think this is going to happen. What might prevent it from happening? I think there are two key issues, accuracy and price. Right now, whole genome sequencing is either really accurate or really inaccurate, depending on who you ask and what you're looking for. The sensitivity and specificity numbers that get thrown out look pretty good, 99.9, 99.99, 99.999. And yet we know that there are whole classes of problems that whole genome sequencing currently doesn't look for, can't see. It's very bad at expanded repeats, for example. Most of the systems that I know of don't phase the chromosomes. So if you've got two mutations, if you show up with two pathogenic mutations in CFTR1, it makes a difference whether they're on the same chromosome or whether they're on each of the two different chromosomes. We need whole genome sequencing that will be able to tell us that. Mike Snyder, who is about the biggest enthusiast for whole everything sequencing, he's done himself. We joke at Stanford. He's the head of genetics at Stanford, and he has done the Snyder-ome, which is every conceivable ome, except, I think, psychological testing. He hasn't gone into that one. Snyder recently published something. He had done whole genome on two different sequencing platforms. And in terms of most of the calls, they did pretty well. They compared like 99% accurate. At least they were the same 99% of the time, whether they were accurate or not. But on short insertions and deletions, 20% concordance. 80% of the time, what one thing said was a deletion or insertion, the other sequencing machine didn't pick up at all. So that's not clinically very useful. It's going to have to get a lot better at what it picks up before we can rely on it, or at least we'll have to be, it'll be a very limited reliance we can put on it. But let's talk about just the straight A's, G's, and T's. How sensitive and specific does it have to be? Well, I teach law students, and it is incredibly difficult to get even brilliant law students to understand that accuracy isn't just one percentage, one thing, just to get to sensitivity and specificity. False negatives, false positives is tricky. To get to positive predictive value is even harder. But I'm hoping with this audience, I don't have to explain positive predictive value. If, let's say, you're looking to see whether somebody has an APOE4 allele, which will be found in about 20, one allele will be found in about 20 to 25% of the population, two alleles homozygous for APOE4, maybe 2 or 3% of the population. And let's say your test is 99.9999, I think I've got the right number of 9, percent sensitive. So it only has a false negative one time in a million. Pretend I did the right number of 9s to make it come out to one time in a million. So you do a million people, you'll get one false negative. Actually, let's do it specificity. You'll get one false positive. How many true positives will you get? Well, if you're looking for heterozygotes and you do 100 million people, yeah, you do a million people, you get 200,000 or so. So a positive result, you can be pretty confident that a positive result there is real. Its positive predictive value is very, very high. The number of false positive results is tiny compared to the number of true positive results. But what if it's not APOE4? What if it's a point mutation in a gene that looks like it changes a codon to a stop codon, early on in what we think is a really important gene, so you'd be really nervous about this, but it's not one we've really seen in the literature before. It is a previously unseen variant. By the way, Stanford just published something on 10 whole genome sequences of, I call them random people, but they were all rich. None of them were charged for their sequences, but the University Medical School kind of has hopes, I think, that downstream this will pay off. They were in the curious, rich, and well-connected category. On average, in those 10 different people, and 7 of them, well, they were 5 and 5 from two major continental-wide ethnicities, they had on average, each one of them, 98,000 sequence variants that had never been seen before or reported in the literature. 100,000 unique things in each person. Now, in 10 years, that won't be 100,000, but it'll still be 10,000. So you got a patient who shows up with something never before seen. It looks really scary, though. It's a stop codon early on in a really important gene in a pathway that you think will lead to, I don't know, cancer of some sort down the road. And let's say your false positive rate is 1 in a million. Well, what's your positive predictive value? We don't know. How many people actually have this mutation? We don't know. If it's one person in a billion, then you'll get 1,000 false positives for every one true positive. The rarer the thing you're looking for, the better your specificity has to be. And there are only so many nines you're going to be able to stick onto that, I think. So it may be that it won't get accurate enough. My guess is we will patch something together with protocols that require retesting, maybe actually saying, test it on two different platforms. And only believe the things that where both platforms say yes. And then for things that look particularly tricky, redo it with Sanger sequencing or some other old-fashioned technique. But to get to really clinical accuracy is going to be hard. And we may not be able to pull it off. Second issue, price. Now, of course, if you talk about doing the whole sequence on two different platforms and then doing a bunch of follow-up, all of that affects the price. And will we be able to get to the $1,000 genome if you're actually doing, say, two different genome-wide sequencing passes plus 15 follow-up, more targeted passes? I don't know. That may be a real issue with the price. Another issue with the price will be the price of the analysis. Another question with the price, and I have no idea in hell how this is going to turn out. I'll be interested to see whether our speakers this afternoon on this issue do. Will patents play a role? Either in terms of the gene patents, or patents on sequencing techniques, or patents on analysis methods? We don't know the answer to that, but I'll note one other bigger thing. So there's a great line in economics, I think it's attributed to Herb Stein. Unsustainable trends will not be sustained. And this, you know, in the healthcare sector, on current trends, by 2053, we'll be spending 134% of our GDP on healthcare. That seems unlikely. On current trends, in 20 years, we'll be able to sequence, complete genome sequence, 20,000 genomes for a dollar. That seems unlikely. And in fact, although those curves are still put up there and they're pretty impressive, I just looked through my notes. It was in September of 2010, I was at a Cold Spring Harbor meeting, and people from Complete Genomics, a company now purchased by Beijing Genomics Institute, were announcing that for special customers, for special deals, for 10 genomes or more, for special friends of Rick's, $4,300 a genome. Well, right now, kind of the street version of that is $3,000 a genome. And we're 2.5 years on. So we are at least at a semi-pause in this cost decline. Not everything keeps going forever. Even Moore's Law will probably end at some point. I flew over here yesterday in an airplane. That airplane goes no faster than the airplanes that were flying that same route 50 years ago. So maybe the price won't come down. So I think what may save us from whole genome sequencing is that the accuracy doesn't get good enough and the price doesn't come down far enough. Or at least the price for an accurate sequence doesn't come down far enough. Apart from that, I think we're toast. But we're not actually toast. I think we will be warmed. How we respond to that will be important. And Mark laid out 10 important issues that will be problems, that are problems now, frankly, but will be much bigger problems in a world with precipitous population-wide whole genome sequencing. And I'm not going to be dreaming about that term. I've had to work so hard to memorize it, Mark. Thank you so much. I would point to four categories briefly. First, the analytic accuracy. As I pointed out, you've got to get awfully accurate. And different machines have different problems. And we don't have a system that's looking at that very hard. I just read the other day that Life Technology has a sequencer that just got Canadian approval. And then I noticed buried down below that 3 months ago it had gotten approval from the FDA under Section 510K. Section 510K is a loophole in device regulation that says if you can show it's substantially equivalent to something that's already out there, it's okay. And thanks to the pressures from the device industry and with the FDA's complicity, you can drive a huge truck through 510K. A friend of mine talks in my FDA class. She had a company that had this cool device, balloons that you put into the spinal column of people whose spines were crushed. You blow up the balloon and then put in a bone cement. And the balloon degrades, and you've got this bone cement keeping the spinal column more vertical. Little old ladies add 3 inches to their height. They straighten up. Good things happen. She wanted to do what's called pre-market approval, do clinical trials. FDA wouldn't let her. They said, oh, no, this is 510K. She said, really? Are there other devices out here that do this? Gosh, we missed them in our check of the market and patents and so on. Well, no, but we use balloons and angioplasties, and we use bone cement in lots of places. Yeah, but nobody's ever done this in spines. No problem. 510K. So if, in fact, we're going to be approving all whole genome, all sequencers as medical devices based on 510K, we're not going to have any regulatory clue of how accurate they are and what they're good at and what they're bad at. And frankly, I think we need to go farther than just how good the machine is, but how good the machine in a particular protocol is. How good it is when you do two passes and then a certain set of follow-up. And unless companies are forced to do that research, either by the FDA or by insurers or someone else, we're not going to know how accurate this stuff is, and that's going to be a problem. Second, even bigger problem, interpretation. Mark touched on this. But great, let's say you've got an absolutely perfect 6.8 billion base pairs of sequence for a diploid genome. Nobody's going to read it. It's going to be done by a computer. To use an acronym from a different field, from computer science, GIGO, garbage in, garbage out. How good that analysis will be depends on how good the people who programmed the computer software was, which will depend on how good their data was. Well, I worry a lot that we'll get a bunch of little companies offering to do this that will not be transparent, that will have proprietary databases and proprietary algorithms, and will say, send us your whole genome sequence, we'll interpret it for you for $50, send you back the report, 50-page report with all these things. Why did we call why did we call this pathogenic and that? Well, we can't tell you, it's proprietary. Is that a paranoid fantasy? No, that's myriad genetics. Well, that may be a paranoid fantasy as well. But we also have experience with this already in the direct-to-consumer SNP chip market, where there used to be three big companies. Two of them are now gone. Navigenics and DecodeMe have given up. They were bought by others who dropped the direct-to-consumer. 23andMe is left. While there were still three, the GAO did this great study. They sent known samples to the three companies, and they said, compared the results. And the good news was, analytically, the three companies were all great. They all called the SNPs pretty much exactly the same. In terms of its clinical significance, they were hugely different. They looked at something like 21 conditions, and they rated each company's response as saying your risk was above average, average, or below average. A third of the time, the companies agreed. A third of the time, one company said high risk and the other company said low risk. And why did they say what they said? Proprietary. If we have that kind of world for whole genome sequencing, I'm very nervous about what's going to happen. Third problem, and the biggest of all, again touched on by Mark, but also others today, and those of you who are counselors certainly know this, conveying the information. So I got into this issue. I was part of a group that did the medical interpretation of Steve Quake's genome. Steve Quake is a Stanford bioengineer who builds sequencing machines, among other things. He's incredibly creative. He sequenced himself for $50,000 back in 2009, which was very, very cheap in 2009. And we decided, hey, with his permission, let's see what we can find out about him. And we found about 100 things. That's where the 100, I think, came from in Mark's number. It turns out we could have said it was 150. We could have said it was 93. 100 was a nice round number. We stopped at 100 things. If it takes 3 minutes per thing to explain to Quake, who is a really bright guy, but a physicist and mathematician by training and an engineer by vocation. 3 minutes a thing, that's 300 minutes, 5 hours. I can talk for 5 hours, although they won't let me today. But nobody can listen to me for 5 hours. Nobody can talk for 5 hours about 100 different miscellaneous, chosen randomly from a hat, genetic issues. Nobody can listen to that, and nobody's going to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Well, we could have the primary care doc do it. Right. The primary care doc might have heard of two of those 100 conditions. How are we going to educate primary care docs? How are we going to educate patients, let alone consumers who aren't going through a medical professional? How, for that matter, are we going to educate genetic counselors to keep up with whole genome sequencing? That's the biggest problem of all. So I see there are a lot of problems, some of which are the same as Mark's, some overlap with Mark's. There are other problems like confidentiality. Note, if in fact everybody's whole genome sequence is in a health record someplace, no need to expand CODIS. There is a forensic database there for any policeman with a subpoena. Yeah, there are confidentiality problems. There are problems about how we treat results with children. There are problems about the borders between research and practice. All sorts of problems. Now, in conclusion, favorite words of any audience, I think that there are two ways to look at this. Well, first, there is one reality. Whole genome sequencing on a precipitous or non-precipitous population-wide basis would cause big problems. The automobile caused big problems. I just looked at the numbers, actually. There were 8,000 cars registered in the United States in 1900. There were 453,000 cars registered in 1910. That caused huge problems. One could say, this is going to cause huge problems. We shouldn't do it. And one maybe should say that. But would you put all your money on the prospect that by saying that you would stop it being done? I don't think so. I think we also need to, although it's good for people to say, we shouldn't do this, or at least not precipitously. It may slow it down, whether it stops it or not. But we also need to think about what countermeasures, what interventions should we take to deal with the problems that will be coming. So my suggestion to you all, my suggestion to Mark is to keep giving that talk. I'll go back to the old title because I really like the old title. Go back to the talk and argue against whole genome sequencing. And for at least many of the rest of us, be aware of the problems and be thinking about when it starts coming, how are we going to deal with it? Thank you.